From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we have a rare opportunity now to talk with someone who speaks for President Trump. Adam Kennedy is Deputy Assistant to the President and joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me on.
So the President said last week on Twitter, if Mexico doesn't immediately stop all illegal immigration coming into the United States through our southern border, I will be closing the border or large sections of the border next week. That would be this week. So when is the closure going to happen?
I think the president has seen more action from Mexico. I think he's seen some good progress. And I think the president is keeping all of his options open. I think what the president wants to do first and foremost is fulfill his primary responsibility to the American people, and that's securing American communities and protecting American lives.
What is the good progress that the president has seen in the last few days from Mexico?
Mexico has been setting up checkpoints. Mexico has been working with us to receive more people seeking asylum. Mexico has been an ongoing partner in this, and they've shown willingness to do even more.
So has Mexico therefore stopped all illegal immigration, as the president said they would need to do in order for him not to close the southern border?
Mexico has been a good partner, and more needs to be done. And again, the president isn't taking any option off the table. He's keeping them open. The president doesn't want to have to close the border. The president has worked for 2 years with Congress, with partners throughout the world to try and solve this problem. Unfortunately, what we've seen is that Democrats in Congress and some people outside the country haven't wanted to work with us. So the president has had to take emergency action, and he's willing to take more action.
But Adam, when people look at what just happened here, it seems like the president is making a big threat that would be of enormous consequence, and then backing off of it a few days later, saying that Mexico is doing something new, when in fact others would look at the situation and say Mexico's been doing all these things all along, or maybe they're making slight tweaks to what they've been doing.
Well, let's be clear. What Mexico has done under this administration is more than almost under any other administration, including setting up an agreement to have asylum seekers wait in Mexico, including setting up more checkpoints. So they've definitely expanded their cooperation.
But not just in the last few days, though. They haven't made all those changes.
Well, that's been going on for a while now, but it's certainly expanded in the last few days. Absolutely. Mexico has shown a willingness to work with us at a greater level than ever before. But also, I just want to emphasize this. A lot of Democrats and a lot of people in this country don't see a crisis at all. We've had law enforcement experts repeatedly say that the border is at a breaking point, that our system is really at a crisis and needs immediate help. And again, Democrats in Congress and people throughout this country have decided not to work with the president to solve the problem.
But what about the idea of threatening to shut down the border and then not carrying through on it? Doesn't that take away the president's credibility when he does something like that?
I think the president has all the credibility in the world on the border. I think he's shown that multiple times. When Congress wouldn't act to provide the funding needed for a barrier, the president acted to get that funding. And I think what the president is showing now is that unless there's immediate action being taken to solve this huge surge at the border, then he will take action.
The president also mentioned yesterday the idea of getting rid of immigration judges at a time when there are already record backlogs in immigration courts. Why would he want to get rid of judges when they're the only ones who are helping people get through the process legally?
Well, I think the president is showing frustration at the process in general. We have these huge backlogs, this very complicated process that requires months, not years, for people to actually be processed. And during that time, because of loopholes in our legal system, these illegal immigrants are allowed to basically roam free in our communities, in our country.
So is the answer to then get rid of judges?
Without proper vetting, without knowing exactly who they are, and that creates serious dangers. In terms of getting rid of the judges, again, the president is frustrated at the current system we have set up in its entirety. There's massive loopholes, there's massive delays, it's not working. And when you have a huge surge like what we're seeing right now, you're seeing it get overwhelmed.
The president also said he's cutting off aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. This is aid that goes to security, to programs to prevent young people from joining gangs in the first place. It's been credited with reducing violence in these countries. Why stop the aid?
Because I think what we're seeing is that most of the illegal immigration is coming from three key countries, and those countries haven't been willing to work with us to stop that. This aid has not stopped this massive immigration. We're seeing hundreds of caravans, each of which have over 100 people in them, swarming our border. So I think what the president's seeing is that we're sending lots of aid down there, but we're not seeing results or accounts, and that's in stopping the immigration flow at our border.
So does he think that by not giving them aid that he's going to get better results in terms of making people not want to flee these countries and come towards the United States?
I think what the president wants to do is make sure we're not throwing good money after bad, that the president is protecting taxpayers and is protecting Americans to make sure that every single dollar is being used to protect them.
What if it leads to an even bigger migration crisis, though, because more people want to leave these countries?
Honestly, we're seeing historic surges right now. They caught over 4,000 people in one day. They're expecting over 100,000 people in a month. This is a massive, massive crisis. I understand that you're saying that there could be even more, but I think what the president is saying is we're already at an extreme breaking point now. This aid has not helped with that, and we need to move forward and make sure that we're solving this crisis that we're facing.
Do you think it's possible that the president will reverse this decision about cutting off the aid as he did with the decision to close down the border this week?
Well, again, I don't think the president reversed anything. I think the president made the option available, said he may do this and is considering it. And I think he's standing behind both options, both cutting the aid and closing the border. I don't think anything has been reversed or taken off the table.
That is Adam Kennedy, who is Deputy Director of Communications and Deputy Assistant to the President. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Well, let's pick up on President Trump's call to cut aid to three Central American countries. Yesterday, we spoke with an advocate of aid who says most of it goes not to governments, but to churches, charities, contractors, and it works. Well, now let's bring in Anita Isaacs, professor at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. Professor, you agree that ending the aid will make things worse, that some of the aid works, but you want changes like what?
So I'd say a couple of things. I think that some of the work in terms of anti-corruption and violence prevention are extremely effective. The major problem is with the aid, which is about half of the aid, which is distributed in terms of economic development and poverty alleviation aid. And the problem here is that we follow a pattern of distributing aid or having that aid being channeled through major foreign contractors who distribute this aid in very large tranches, very large packages, basically dumping it on community organizations and ignoring the capacity of these organizations to absorb that assistance. We need to increase aid and restructure the way development aid is distributed by listening to communities rather than come with already sort of defined programs about what kind of development aid is needed within the communities.
But then how do you pressure governments?
The governments are indifferent to whether or not the poorer sectors of their society receive development aid. And in fact, they benefit from the migration of their citizens to the United States because the amount of money that migrants contribute in remittances is either the first or the second largest contributor to the gross domestic product of these countries.
I have to jump in with a stat that you have, which is astonishing. You say the $500 million or so in aid, down from about the $700 million that the Obama administration sent to these countries in 2017, was less than 3% of the money they received as remittance every year. So you, as you say, they have something to gain by programs not working and people fleeing violence and poverty.
Absolutely. They have everything to gain.
So how do you change that? If you say, yes, restructure the aid so it better goes to communities, how do you cross over that firewall and somehow make it impact the governments there?
Well, the problem is with the nature of the governments. We have a promising new election in El Salvador that promises to bring an untainted, centrist kind of maverick into office. And there is every reason, instead of beginning by denouncing the country, to try to find ways to work with him. The other two countries, and the country I know best is Guatemala, are run basically by organized crime, corrupt criminal operations. What we need to do in these countries is to pressure these corrupt regimes by publicly denouncing corrupt members of the business community, corrupt members of the government, corrupt members of the judicial system, and also to deny, to revoke their visas to the United States. Something that's really important to understand is that the powerful and wealthy within these countries live large segments of their lives in the United States. The idea of denying them entry and seizing their assets in the United States would go a long way to really lighting a fire under them towards rethinking the corrupt and criminal practices that they're engaged in.
Well, and as you write, Congress is already pushing this. They have revoked visas of corrupt public officials and business people.
They have, but they have been doing that because they've been able to gain a little bit of wiggle room within a State Department that is preoccupied with Venezuela, in my view. And so this is not a stated policy. They've been pushing this, but the Trump administration isn't on board. And if the Trump administration really is interested in curbing migration from these countries, then it is right to shine the spotlight on Central American governments. Cutting aid is not the way to do it because these governments don't care about whether or not aid is distributed. But twisting their arms by preventing them to visit their houses in Miami or wherever else they live is a means of changing the stripes of these governments. And until such time as these governments assume their responsibility, we're going to continue to see mass migration from these regions.
That's Anita Isaacs, professor of political science at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. Professor Isaacs, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And let's pick up on politics with our political strategists. Joining us today are Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. Hi, Maria.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And let's start with the president's sort of reversals, I guess you could say, this week. Last week, he renewed his push to repeal Obamacare. Now he says he doesn't want to do it until after the election. He said last week, as we just heard, that he will shut down the border with Mexico. Now the White House is sort of backing off that threat. Alice, does he risk anything by making these big declarations and then a few days later stepping back from it?
Well, if history is any indication, no. This is par for the course for what this president does. And in his mind, he views this as a way to start the conversation. And look, he campaigned and many Republicans campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare. And that is something that Americans want with regard to fixing and correcting our health care. It's just the question is how to go about doing this. I think his announcement or decision to say he's going to close the border is extremely problematic. I also think cutting off aid to the Northern Triangle is a problem. I've seen the benefits of aid to the Northern Triangle, and it needs to remain. I've seen USAID in action, and if he does move forward with cutting off the aid, it will have the reverse effect with regard to people coming up into this country. It will create greater instability there, and people will leave the country. So I think a lot of this is him starting the conversation, and that's important. But I don't see major changes with regard to some of these proposals that he's putting out there.
Well, Maria, how should Democrats respond to these things?
Well, I think they're responding exactly how they responded in 2018, which is, thank you, President Trump, for making health care yet a big focal point going into 2020, because it is what allowed us to take over the House of Representatives in 2018. Look, health care continues to be the number one issue. And frankly, I hope Republicans on the Hill have health care, because they're suffering from whiplash in terms of what this president has said publicly and then has reiterated that he's going to go the opposite way and then saying, oh, he's not going to deal with it until after the 2020 election. But regardless, he has handed Democrats, frankly, the issue that they were going to run on anyway in 2020.
Well, Maria, that brings me to another question about the Democrats, because we don't really know right now where they stand, especially because there are so many presidential candidates who want to, you know, differentiate themselves. But we don't know where they stand exactly on health care. Senate Democrats unveiled a health care plan called Medicare X, which would make Medicare a public health insurance option. But it's not Medicare for all, which some are pushing for.
Right.
What do you think of where the Democrats are in healthcare right now?
Well, and this is, again, why I thank the president, because he actually has handed the Democrats a blanket issue that they can all run on, which is protecting the Affordable Care Act. And then, yes, if they want to talk about Medicare for all in terms of the next step, that's fine. But right now, what Americans see is that the Affordable Care Act is in jeopardy. And the majority of Americans support the Affordable Care Act, including the majority majority of Republicans. In fact, there was a poll this morning that said 9 out of 10 voters do not trust Trump at all, nor Republicans, to take care of America's health care system. And they trust Democrats. So again, thank you, President Trump, for unifying the 2020 candidates going into the 2020 presidential in terms of protecting the Affordable Care Act and ensuring that Americans, all Americans, especially those with pre-existing conditions, are afforded the protections that they need.
Alice? I think it's really, if I can just say this, Medicare for All might sound great to a lot of those on the left and Democrats as a campaign talking point, but that is government-run health care. It is a single-payer system that is not sustainable, and that does not provide Americans with what they want, what they have said for years they want. They want greater access to care. They want lower deductibles. They want to keep their doctors. If they like their doctor, they want to keep it, which has not been the case. And they want quality, affordable health care, and they're not getting it right now. And so I no matter how the Democrats want to call it, it's simply not sustainable, and Americans do want something different.
They want the Affordable Care Act, which the president now wants to take away. So thank you, Trump.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the Mueller report and the Barr letter. Now, the House Judiciary Committee voted this morning to give the chairman, Jerry Nadler, the power to subpoena the Justice Department to release the full Mueller report on the Russia investigation, which we will say found no collusion and didn't rule either way, really, on obstruction of justice, according to the attorney general. Nadler told reporters he would not negotiate on what's redacted.
The committee must see everything, as was done in every prior instance. Obviously, some material will have to be redacted before it's released to the public to protect privacy, to protect the various rights. But the committee is entitled and must see all the material.
Now, there's not going to be a subpoena right away. They're giving the attorney general more time. Maria, why are Democrats holding their fire on demanding the full Mueller report now?
Because I think they do want to give this Department of Justice and this Attorney General the chance to do the right thing, even though knowing that he is somebody who came into this job with a very strong political point of view against the Mueller investigation and for almost complete authoritative executive power. But having said that, we're going to give him some time, which I think is the right thing to do, but with the understanding that the committee should see every single piece of this report. They should understand what was behind Mueller's findings. That way they can actually do their job of oversight, which frankly, in the last 2 years of Republican leadership in Congress, has been non-existent.
Alice, do you agree with that?
And frankly, the majority of Americans believe that the Mueller report should be seen by the public.
I think they're entering into troubled waters here. Look, I don't understand why their hair is all of a sudden on fire about the releasing this report. Barr has said he is going to release it. He has said that certain information does need to be redacted. So they're continuing to pound their fists on the table and threaten subpoenas is really unnecessary. And the rate to continue to throw out the word subpoena every time someone gets their pizza toppings wrong, it cheapens the process. And we need to wait. We need to let Barr do the correct redactions. As we all know, they need to protect the classified information, the sources and methods, people that have not been indicted, as well as information that needs to be protected. And Barr is doing that. He has said so. The president has said that he wants to do that. They need to just calm down,
the president,
be patient,
now,
and let this legal process take its course.
The president has now walked that back, and he does not want this report out, and I think there's a reason for that. I think he knows that there is danger there for him. But look, what we are saying is that don't let America, the whole public, see an unredacted report. No, the committee should see it. Everybody on that committee has the proper, you know, classifications in terms of being able to see classified information. So they should see it. There's no reason to redact pieces of it for the committee. Then they will ensure that the proper redactions are made when the report is made public.
Okay, let's move on to 2020 in the few minutes that we have left, because there's a lot to talk about. And starting with the former Vice President Joe Biden, two more women have come forward to claim that he touched them in a way that made them uncomfortable. That means four women have now accused him of that. And at a Politico forum yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi weighed in on what Biden said and what he should say.
So to say I'm sorry that you were offended is not an apology. I'm sorry I invaded your space.
Now, Maria, you've joined other Democrats such as Pelosi in saying this hasn't been disqualifying for Biden in terms of getting into the race. What do you think now?
I still think that's true, but I've also qualified that qualification by saying that it all depends on how he answers these questions, because he's going to continue to get them. He does need to acknowledge that his actions, no matter how innocuous and innocent they were, and I do believe they were innocuous and innocent, but he needs to acknowledge that those actions made women feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. He needs to acknowledge that, apologize for that, and say that he is going to check his behavior from here on out.
Alice, here's President Trump joking about these problems with Biden last night.
I was going to call him. I don't know him well. I was going to say, welcome to the world, Joe. You having a good time, Joe?
So, you know, Kellyanne Conway was on one of the Sunday talk shows over the weekend, and she was talking about creepy Uncle Joe, which sort of brings up the old phrase about people who live in glass houses not throwing stones. I mean, this is President Trump, somebody who bragged on tape about grabbing women.
Right. And look, I think there is no comparison here. I've gone repeatedly on record saying that the words that have come out of this president's mouth are disturbing and should not be tolerated. And look, inappropriate touching, inappropriate language to women that makes them feel uncomfortable is not right. And it's not about the person's intent, as Joe Biden has said. It's not what they intended to do. It is how these women feel. And I'm glad we are able to have this conversation. And it's important to realize, while this is wrong, the behavior should not be tolerated. It's like getting a speeding ticket. Going over the speed limit 5 miles an hour is much different than going over the speed limit 55 miles an hour. And I think we need to take each and every one of these instances separately and individually. Joe Biden, in my view, is someone that should be respected and has a long history in politics. I don't believe this is disqualifying, but it is his decision and his family's decision to make as to what he does moving forward.
And I agree with Alice on this. And frankly, before Kellyanne talks about this again, she needs to remember that she is working for a self-professed sexual predator in the White House right now.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll leave it right there. But thank you so much to both of you. Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist. Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist. And lots to talk about as this race for president goes on. Some fundraising numbers coming in. We will discuss it all in the coming days. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Amazon says that as of today, shoppers should see lower prices on some items at Whole Foods, which Amazon owns. The price cuts reflect Amazon's attempt to lure more Prime members to the grocery chain, still battling a reputation for being too expensive. For more on this and some other corporate stories in the news today, let's bring in Charisse Jones, national business correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
And we recall that Amazon acquired Whole Foods for $14 billion back in 2017. It thought Prime members would start shopping there, but so far only 18% say they do at least once per month. And I have to say, I'm not that surprised because, you know, when I go to Whole Foods, maybe I spend $100 and get $1.50 off with my Prime savings. So what's going on here?
Yeah, that's the big complaint. I mean, you're actually supposed to get an extra 10% off of everything on sale as a Prime member. But basically, they're saying now that, you know, Prime members are going to be able to get double the deals they used to get every week that are exclusive to them. And that's going to be in addition to hundreds of other items that are on sale for anybody that walks into a Whole Foods store. So the whole point is they're trying to get people to give them another chance because prices have been creeping up again at Whole Foods. And there's a lot of alternatives at this point if you want to get organic products and goods.
So what kind of price cuts can we expect?
They're talking about an average of 20% off, and it's going to be primarily produce, so fruits and vegetables. You can get a pound of organic asparagus or strawberries for 99 cents instead of $2.99. So again, they're really trying to make another play. It's the third big price cut they've had since it was purchased by Amazon. But because those prices were going in the other direction, people kind of feel there was an okey-doke there. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to lure them back in and saying, you don't have to go to Walmart. You don't have to go to Aldi's. You can get some good stuff here for a lower price as well.
Well, we'll see if they're for real this time. meanwhile, in other food-related news, we learned this week that two airports are canceling their deals with Chick-fil-A. That would be Buffalo Niagara International and San Antonio International Airport. They say the chain is not welcome in their food courts. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, Chick-fil-A is incredibly popular. There's one that just opened a few blocks from my office and everybody's clamoring to go. But it's also incredibly controversial. They have a foundation, Think Progress, that's given money to organizations that are considered anti-gay, anti-LGBT. And their chairman has said that he's against gay marriage. And so the San Antonio City Council and the New York State Assembly, some of their members said that it doesn't have a place in these airports. Chick-fil-A says that they don't have a political agenda, but there's a lot of critics who disagree.
And do they have a legal backing? Do they have legal right to do that, to say you can't be in these airports?
Yeah, I mean, airports have a right to say who they contract with, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, in Texas, the state attorney general, who happens to be a Republican, has launched an investigation because the mayor of San Antonio has said that his criticism was that Chick-fil-A is not open on Sunday. And he feels that that's going to impact revenue. And the state attorney general says that this might infringe on your right to religious freedom. So we might yet see a Chick-fil-A at the San Antonio airport.
Okay, just a couple seconds here, but we saw that Caterpillar, which is a bellwether for the global economy, saw its stock downgraded by Deutsche Bank this week. Why?
Yeah, it's been a perfect storm. You know, economies are struggling a bit in Europe and in China. The United States is oversaturated with that kind of equipment. Mm-hmm. But it might be a little bit premature, so we have to see. But in the meantime, they're saying they're cool on Caterpillar.
Charisse Jones, national business correspondent for USA Today. Thank you.
Thank you.
In his State of the State address in February, California Governor Gavin Newsom touched on all the standard talking points: immigration, high-speed rail, the economy, medieval diseases.
Last year, we had a hepatitis A outbreak in San Diego. Recently, there was an outbreak of syphilis up in Sonoma, typhus in Los Angeles. Typhus, a medieval disease in California in 2019.
And typhus isn't the only medieval disease making a resurgence in this country. There's also plague and shigellosis and something called Bartonella quintana. What's going on? Dr. Jeffrey Duchin is on the faculty at the University of Washington and a board member with the Infectious Disease Society of America. And Dr. Duchin, we know your society is abuzz about this, but many might be hearing about diseases like typhus for the first time. So start with, what is typhus?
Well, typhus is a group of diseases caused by bacteria that get transmitted to humans by insects such as fleas and lice. And there are several types of typhus, but what we're hearing about here in the U.S. is the flea-borne typhus. That's called murine typhus.
How bad does typhus get?
Well, you can think of it as a real severe flu-like illness, high fever, muscle aches, headache, stomach pain. And typically, it's not fatal, but it can be in rare cases, but it's a very uncomfortable disease.
Well, there were 167 cases diagnosed over the last year, and some are saying it's because of an increase in homelessness, people coming in contact maybe with flea-ridden rats and other things. And they're also saying that homelessness might be contributing to the rise in other infectious diseases because of the hygiene in homeless camps. Talk about that.
So unsheltered homelessness is an increasing national problem. In 10 states, California, Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, and others, more than half of the individuals who are experiencing homelessness are living unsheltered and are vulnerable to a wide range of health problems. Infectious diseases and communicable diseases are one, and there are enteric diseases like Shigella and hepatitis A.
What is Shigella?
Shigella is a bacterial infection, very highly infectious, mm-hmm. And hepatitis A is another infection of the liver that spreads the same way through small bits of feces or stool that can contaminate the environment or hands in people who are living in conditions that are crowded. These diseases spread very, very effectively. And in the U.S. currently, multiple states are reporting very large outbreaks of hepatitis A. We've had over 10,000 cases reported in the past couple of years.
Well, and to be even more direct than you've been, there are, and this is difficult to hear, but there are feces all over in these homeless encampments. And, you know, we're reading about a woman who lives in one who regularly pours water and hydrogen peroxide on the sidewalk to try to do something about it. Cities have tried to wash down streets and sidewalks with a mixture like that to try to fight this. Short of getting people into homeless shelters, which, you know, some that might say aren't that much better, but are certainly a step up when it comes to hygiene. How do cities attack this?
Well, clearly, supportive housing and housing availability is the key. However, if it's not possible, we need to at least be able to improve our ability to deliver street-based care for mental health and for physical health, vaccinations, allow people to be treated for those conditions that they're suffering from. It's very difficult for people who have underlying medical conditions, which the homeless suffer from to a degree that's much greater than people who are housed, with respect to chronic diseases, mental health, trauma, and wounds, you name it. It's very difficult for these folks to access medical care for their chronic conditions, for new things like infections that develop, and having the ability to deliver care where they are would be a great improvement. But the real bottom line is better housing, in particular supportive housing, that can help manage the multiple comorbidities or other underlying physical and behavioral health problems that homeless can suffer from.
Yeah. Well, something worth really thinking about, not just because of the crises that are already happening, but because you and others have pointed to climate change bringing back more diseases. And again, these are called medieval diseases because, you know, in medieval times, people lived in these kinds of squalid conditions and these diseases spread. But what are your thoughts on climate change and these diseases?
Climate clearly impacts the range and distribution of the insects that can transmit diseases. Climate clearly impacts the range and distribution of the animals that are reservoirs or host species for these diseases that can be transmitted to humans. And it's thought that with the typhus situation, you know, the disease has been well established in tropical and subtropical areas, but it's moving northward. There have been pretty well documented descriptions of Lyme disease expanding its range and moving northward, both in Europe and in the U.S. But it's not just climate. There are a variety of factors that influence whether humans will become infected with these types of diseases that have reservoirs in nature. And that includes, in addition to climate, how land is used, whether there are increasing encroachments on the natural environment by humans, either through deforestation or humans moving into areas that they previously didn't live in, where animal reservoirs are, how they interact with the environment, the types of animals that are present and how we relate to them. Do we, you know, have close contact with the animals in nature or not? So human behavior, the built environment, and land use and how humans interact with their environment, in addition to climate, really all will come into play when we talk about risk. But climate clearly is one factor that is in play right now. And we won't know really the full extent of this until we are able to study it more thoroughly. Right now, we don't have good surveillance systems in place to monitor the progression of diseases in the border areas where they're occurring. And that's a really crucial thing to do from the public health perspective in the context of knowing how climate might be influencing the spread of infectious diseases over time.
Well, before we let you go, and if we haven't already scared the bejesus out of everybody, we have to ask you about the 4 deaths from plague, 16 cases. You know, when we think of plague, you know, we think of no survivors, you know. What is plague?
Plague is a bacterial disease caused by Yersinia pestis. It is a disease that lives in small mammals and then can be, again, transmitted to humans by the bites of fleas most commonly. Both the reservoir species, the rodents, and the bacteria themselves are thought to be influenced by climate. And there is some research to suggest that The geographic area where plague occurs may be expanding in response to our warming planet.
But what is it? How do you feel when you have it?
Oh, plague is a horrible disease. It's a bacterial infection that typically gets into the bloodstream or the lymph nodes. It can go to the lungs. It's very rapidly progressive and highly lethal unless it's treated. It's extremely treatable with antibiotics. But if it's not recognized promptly, it can be fatal.
Dr. Jeffrey Duchin on the faculty at the University of Washington, board member of the Infectious Disease Society of America, on some medieval diseases making their way back into this society. Doctor, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Well, now we want to take a second to note Mozambique, a country which is ravaged by disease. 2 weeks after Cyclone Idai hit Mozambique, cholera is spreading quickly, and public health officials fear that malaria and measles may follow. Government officials are confirming more than 1,000 cases of cholera. Clinics are seeing hundreds of cases a day. Workers there say some victims are already dead when they're carried in. Of the country's 9 treatment centers, 8 are being run and staffed by Doctors Without Borders and the International Red Cross Federation. On a positive note, 900,000 doses of cholera vaccine have arrived in the country, and a vaccination campaign is underway today. That is, people on the ground await 700,000 mosquito nets, which they hope will prevent a massive malaria outbreak. The WHO is asking for $40 million to cover operations in Mozambique through June.
It is an historic day in Chicago, which just elected Lori Lightfoot, a former federal prosecutor, as Chicago's first African-American woman mayor. Lightfoot is also openly gay, and Chicago is now the largest U.S. city to ever elect an openly gay mayor. Lightfoot won a landslide victory, earning 74% of the vote against Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Here's Lightfoot speaking last night.
Today, you did more than make history. You created a movement for change.
Joining us now is WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos in Chicago. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Lori Lightfoot won this election by a wide margin. She got 74% of the vote, as we said. Now, you told us yesterday that she had the momentum, but how do you make sense of such a landslide?
I think the poll showed her up by 25, 30 points. Even Preckwinkle supporters knew that they were going to lose badly, that it would be a landslide. But this is the biggest margin of victory that any mayoral candidate has racked up since the days when the machine was really still churning on all cylinders in 2003 when Mayor Richard M. Daley got reelected with, I think, 78% of the vote. Lori Lightfoot won every one of the city's 50 wards, and Tony Preckwinkle only won a handful of the precincts around where she lives by the University of Chicago.
And by the way, you mentioned Richard M. Daley. There was a Daley who was running in this mayor's race but was knocked out in the first round. So the machine obviously did not do well. She Lightfoot, said that she was not part of the machine. What does she plan to do now?
Well, it's hard to say because nobody was able to pin her or any of the other candidates down really with a specific plan to deal with the huge financial problems that the city of Chicago has. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars in underfunded pensions. And without boring you with the details, it's just simply a matter of either raising more revenue or cutting. And it's been very, very politically unpalatable. It really, really diminished Rahm Emanuel's popularity over the last two terms in office as mayor to have to make cuts, close schools, close mental health clinics, mm-hmm. raise taxes. So what will Lori Lightfoot do? She's discounted some of the options and come up with some options, but nothing close to balancing the books yet.
A significant issue in Chicago is the divide between the police and the black community following the 2015 police shooting of Laquan McDonald, an unarmed black 17-year-old. Here's Lightfoot talking about that this morning on Morning Edition.
The truth is that the nature of policing that has not adequately taken into account the segregation in our city and that race does matter has left many people feeling like the police are an illegitimate occupying force. And we got to change that around because literally lives depend on it.
So what does Lightfoot plan to do, or what do we know about what she plans to do to deal with the relationship between the police and the community?
She has experience in this area. You know, she worked under Daley's administration for the agency that would look at complaints. She was the head of the Police Review Board, which is an oversight panel under Emanuel. But it's very difficult for a mayor because you're really stuck in the middle of a huge gulf here. She has supporters who are very pro-police. She has supporters who are even pro-Donald Trump. And how do you keep them happy as well as some of the progressives that have backed her? There are some people in the police accountability movement that don't believe that she will do what's necessary in that realm.
Dan, what about the history of all of this? She is going to be the first black female mayor ever of Chicago. There have been two African-American mayors in the city's history right around the same time, a few decades ago. And she will also be the first openly gay mayor of a city as large as Chicago in this country.
That's right. History was made. There had not been a black mayor for more than 30 years and something like 36 years since there was a woman mayor in Chicago. And there was only one woman who's been mayor before Lori Lightfoot out of the 50 plus mayors that will precede her. So it's a historic day. And I think that in this race is much more subtle, I think, than some of the tribal politics that we've had in Chicago over the decades. She started with a base really in the white, liberal, north side, lakefront wards, and then had to kind of introduce herself to African-American voters and had to rely on some other candidates that did well in the first round to endorse her and show her around the South and West sides.
What was the turnout like yesterday?
Turnout was very, very low. I think it might have been a record low. I'm looking for confirmation from the election board today, but not a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of apathy, actually, among the voters. I think it was about 30% of the registered voters who are themselves only about half of the eligible voters. So You're talking about a fraction of a fraction here. But she's claiming a mandate because she won big.
That's Dan Mihalopoulos, reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.